I admit I was a little disappointed when they postponed the Tiger game last night because of the cold. I was perversely looking forward to seeing baseball players in stocking caps and maybe some snow flurries during the game. I'm not sure why I enjoy that. A character flaw, no doubt. The football game, there was an NFL game the season before last, a Lions game, I believe, where they played in like 6 or 8 inches of snow. Hugely entertaining. I mean, a real spectacle. And where this sadistic tendency comes from, I do not know. We've got a psychologist coming up in a few minutes. Maybe he can help me. Welcome back to Current State on WKAR. Mark Bayshore here. We're glad you're along. 59 different taxes. 59 different taxes yielding nearly $40 billion in public revenue. That's a snapshot of current Michigan tax levies contained in a comprehensive new report. That money is used to pay for police and fire protection, Medicaid coverage, state employee salaries, schools, roads, and lots more. The Citizens Research Council of Michigan compiles its Michigan tax outline every year or two. The document's a summary of all existing state taxes and major local taxes and all kinds of related data, like how many dollars each tax generated, along with a review of recent tax changes. The nonpartisan group chose Tax Day, April 15th, to release this year's outline, so the lines at the bookstores are just starting to shorten as we speak. They've been flying off the shelves. And to learn more, we turn to Bob Schneider, Director of State Affairs for the Citizens Research Council of Michigan. Bob, welcome to Current State.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Seriously, tell us more about who your report is for. Who or what organizations tear into this thing?
This is our most popular report, and I think it's very broadly used. We started publishing the tax outline in 1964. It's a very long longevity report. At that time, it had 41 taxes. Now the 59 taxes that are in the report. And it gets used by a whole host of folks. I think other public policy researchers dip into our report. I know students use it. Government folks in state government and local governments, our friends in our associations in Lansing, lobbyists. We get 2,000 hits a month to the report on our website, and it's definitely our most popular one. That'll probably jump a bit when we do our update here. Once we've released it, but it's definitely a very popular report, and I think it's probably one of our more broadly read ones.
Go a little bit deeper with us, though. Give us an example or two, if you can, of how your data is used by one of these groups.
Right. I can give you a couple examples. Back in November, I attended a forum sponsored by the Michigan League for Public Policy. They did a budget forum focusing on fiscal challenges to local governments, and former state budget director Mary Lanois was a presenter at their session, and she did a review of big picture local revenue issues, and I was very pleased. I attended and was pleased to see she drew heavily on our tax outline and cited us in the data that she compiled on sort of that broad-based look, big picture look at the revenue scene. And on the other end of the spectrum, perhaps just a couple months ago, I got a call from an online retailer, and they were looking at one very specific element of our tax outline. We do a little table that reviews city income taxes as a list of all 22 cities that levy an income tax, what the rate is, how much they collect on an annual basis. They were interested. Apparently, they've been tracking that table over a number of years and trying to keep tabs on what cities assess for income tax for their own internal purposes. Hmm. So, in general, this is something used by a little bit of everybody. I think the most common use is somebody that just needs to learn a factoid about one tax or another and is using it as sort of a ready reference to learn and refresh their memory on element of the
we'll
taxes.
Revisit that online retailing piece here in just a minute, because that does play into a larger issue. We'll get to that in just a minute. You describe one trend from the new outline released yesterday as noteworthy. It shows a real contrast between tax revenues accruing to the state government compared to local governments. What did you discover exactly?
We saw a pretty significant difference in state revenue trends and in local revenue trends in the taxes. And it's sort of a flip from what maybe you'd seen 10 years ago. For local revenues, we saw about we have a table in the outline that reviews recent tax collections for every tax that's in the outline from 2000. We do a four-year history, 2009 to 2012 in this particular version of the tax outline. From 2009 to 2012, we saw local revenues, primarily driven by property tax declines, dip by $1 billion over that four-year period. Mm-hmm. That's about an 8% decline in that in total local revenues from those taxes. On the other end, the state revenues went up. They went up by about $1.3 billion over that same four-year period, which is roughly a 5% increase over that time. Hardly mind-blowing, but at least state revenues on the upside. Local revenues
definitely,
you know, definitely constrained.
And not too surprisingly, this generated a pretty sharp response yesterday from the Michigan Municipal League, which called it an outrage and said, after taking our money, the state then has the audacity to criticize Michigan cities and villages for not operating efficiently. It would be like someone taking money out of your wallet and then a day later penalizing you for not having any money. That's quite a shot. Does your report typically generate responses like this from a stakeholder, or was that more unusual?
The tax outline generally doesn't get those types of responses, since generally the tax outline is more of an informational reference document. But I think, you know, we talked about examples of how folks use our tax outline. I think that's another example of, I think, MML basically recognized in looking at those revenue trends that we showed in the report that, you know, they told a story. And, of course, revenue sharing is not a specific component of our report, but in an era where revenue sharing has been going down to local governments.
But the data is relevant, certainly.
The other local revenues continue to go down. State revenues are going up. And I think from MML's perspective of saying maybe it's time to look at sharing some more of those revenues with local governments, given our revenue constraints with property taxes.
Does your report get more closely looked at in an election year?
I suppose all of our reports probably get more closely looked at in an election year.
Speaking of municipal revenue, one of the recent tax changes that you document is the recent phasing out of the personal property tax. That's been long considered an impediment to growth and hiring by the business community. How much will the phase out of the PPT change the revenue landscape from your perspective?
Well, and you're correct. I mean, the personal property tax, you know, is essentially a levy on, you know, business equipment, machinery, technology, you know, business infrastructure, and business investment. And the business community has always said, you know, this is a disincentive for us to invest in our businesses and you know, create jobs and expand our businesses. The problem has always been that local units of government depend on that personal property tax revenue for a significant chunk of revenue, and estimated in an order of maybe $500 to $600 million on an annual basis. So in past efforts, the issue has always been, how do you replace that? How do you replace that revenue to local governments so that you don't further gut needed local services? Mm-hmm. And that has happened with this legislative proposal. That revenue will be replaced to local governments, and the legislation that was just enacted revised that reimbursement process and set up two things. So first, the state assesses a use tax on individuals, and that use tax, a portion of it, the existing use tax, not an increase in the use tax, a portion of the existing use tax will be levied now by a special new authority. And they will have control of that revenue, and they will use that revenue to reimburse local governments for the revenue losses under the personal property tax exemptions that were passed. The other piece of that is a new state essential services assessment. That's covered in the tax outline as well and reviewed. And under that assessment, the state will begin collecting a lower rate, a lower millage rate on that same exempted personal property. So instead of paying a higher local property tax, this smaller state assessment will be levied, and the state will use that revenue to sort of top off the reimbursement to local units of government. So that's how they got around that long-term
problem. In theory, they've made both sides of the ledger connect with one another, and now this still goes before the voters later this year.
Correct. This will be on the ballot in August.
Still subject to a popular vote. Our guest is Bob Schneider, Director of State Affairs for the Citizens Research Council of Michigan. We're talking about the CRC's, we can't say annual. It's every year or two they publish a Michigan tax outline. The use tax came up yesterday in an MLive story as well. Apparently, the state treasury relies on voluntary reporting of online purchases from out-of-state companies. And because the great majority of Michigan taxpayers simply don't include that in their tax returns, it apparently costs the state close to $500 million, at least according to this story. Can you flesh that out for us anymore?
The use tax again is an element of the tax outline, and remote sales. You know, if you buy an item via the internet or via a catalog from a company in California. That company generally, if it doesn't have an attachment to the state of Michigan, doesn't have what they call nexus in the state of Michigan, they're not required to collect the sales tax. Legally, you're required to give the state the fallback use tax on that. And again, that's a very difficult
thing to enforce
at the state level. They've put it on the income tax returns now. You're supposed to hopefully file that information with your taxes. But again, it's a challenge for the state. And it's on I think estimates are in that article. I did see that article as well. The $500 million in revenue.
That's significant. Yeah. Do you make policy recommendations at the CRC, or is your focus really just raw data?
We many times we do not make policy recommendations. We're focused on trying to provide context and information to the citizenry so that they can learn about a public policy area. But if we do, we have in the past made policy recommendations if we feel that our analysis of the data or our analysis of underlying policy issues, if there's some common sense recommendations that can be made, we will make policy recommendations. We just put a report out in January on the ballot question process. How do we go from collecting signatures on a petition initiative to getting that on the ballot? And that was a report published in January. There we looked at what are Michigan's procedures. What's Michigan's level of oversight versus what do we see in other states? And we did make some recommendations. We recommended that Michigan go to sort of more of a front-end review of those petitions to look at the language and approve it in advance before we start going out and collecting signatures to avoid the legal issues that we've had in the courts in the past with some of those initiatives. And more disclosure of financial contributions to those ballot campaigns. So when we think it's warranted, we will make policy.
Interesting. I have to ask you about the quotation that your organization puts at the top of some of your web pages. CRC, what is it?
CRC MICH.org.
Correct. It's from the Michigan CRC's first executive director, a Mr. Lent Upson, who said, the right to criticize government is also an obligation to know what you're talking about, unquote. That ought to be famous.
Yeah, I like that quote, too. I think it really encapsulates what we do at CRC. We want to be an organization that the public can turn to when you're not looking for spin, you're not looking to be told to vote yes or no on this issue, but you want just the facts. You want unbiased background so that you can learn, as Dr. Upson said, you can know what you're talking about so that you can go and make an informed vote on whether it's a ballot initiative or a piece of legislation that's moving through the legislature. I think our mission and our role is to provide that nonpartisan, unbiased information to the public. And hopefully that helps improve policy making as well.
On the federal level, I think of the Congressional Budget Office, too. They have a reputation for unbiased data.
It's very similar. I used to work for the House Fiscal Agency.
Exactly.
They're very similar to the House Fiscal Agency, but in very similar ways. I think we've earned that reputation for being fair and unbiased in what we do. And I think that's what brings a lot of value to our reports.
Bob Schneider is the Director of State Affairs for the Citizens Research Council of Michigan. We've been talking about their brand new Michigan tax outline that they publish every year or two. You can find it online at crcmich.org. Bob Schneider, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Mark. I appreciate it.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Do you tend to see the glass half full or half empty? Do you wish you could see it fuller sometimes? Well, according to a new study in the Journal of Abnormal Psychology, there seems to be a lot more at play than just telling yourself to look on the bright side. The study by Jason Moser, who's an MSU assistant professor in psychology, is the first to show that brain activity is actually different between positive and negative thinkers. And Dr. Jason Moser is here to discuss his recent findings. Welcome to Current State.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about what you looked at in this study and how you conducted it.
Well, we were really looking at the brain activity of people who report in their daily lives that they tend to think positively about things or objectively about things versus people who report saying, I generally worry, I generally think about the worst possible outcome. And we brought those people who say that about themselves on questionnaires when we asked them these things into the lab, and we asked them to watch pretty nasty pictures actually on our computer screen while we record their brain activity. And we wanted to see what happened to their brains, these different types of people, when we when we specifically asked them to look on the bright side of these pictures. And we said, when you see these pictures, try to think of a positive outcome. So if you see a woman standing there at knife point with a masked man, think about her breaking away to safety and running away. Hmm. And we asked both of these types, all of these types of people really, to do that. And when we looked at their brain activity, there was really big differences between people who said in general they think positively versus people who think negatively.
How do you know whether the so-called negative thinkers were just in a bad mood the day that you did the test? I mean, they're supposedly chronically kind of thinking on the dark side.
Absolutely, yeah. These are people for whom this pattern of thinking is really stuck in place.
And you can tell how people are feeling? How do you measure that?
So in the brain, we're measuring electroencephalogram, or EEG. This is just the electrical activity that naturally goes on in your brain. And when we look at that, we can look at different patterns of brain activity when people look at these pictures. And what we saw is the emotional brain, this emotional brain signal we could get, was really quiet in the positive thinkers, but it was really loud and really very, very large in the negative thinkers. So they kind of went in complete opposite directions when we were actually expecting everyone, when they were looking on the bright side, to quiet down their emotional brain. But it was the really worriers or these negative thinkers whose brain actually lit up even more when we were trying to say, think positively. So it was kind of this backfiring effect we saw.
Hmm. You showed that it was difficult then for negative thinkers to come up with a positive outcome from this disturbing image. But were they able to do it if they tried hard enough? I mean, was the level of effort a factor here? Did you measure that in any way? Look at that.
Yes, we did. We asked them to tell us how effortful the task was. So we asked them in questionnaire, and they actually said that they tried hard and it actually took more effort for them. So they actually reported, this was effortful for me to do. I found the task very hard, whereas positive thinkers didn't really say that the task was hard or easy. So these negative thinkers reported that, and what we also saw in the brain, even before the picture came up, when we gave them the instruction, okay, now when you see this next picture, try to think on the bright side, we already saw that they were kind of getting ready and trying to put effort in ahead of time, but that effort, even though they were trying, actually backfired, and they ended up doing worse.
Huh. Have you ever wondered if you conversely showed people positive images and ask them to think of negative outcomes?
Yeah, people are really interested in how the brain does both things, looks on the bright side, and then can you actually look on the more negative side? Especially, we're doing some research looking at people who are more psychopathic, let's say, who have difficulties with emotions, and we want to actually see, can they look on the negative side to create some empathy? So we are trying to sort these things out between different types of people.
I'm sure you try to keep an open mind before you enter any study like this, but were you surprised at all about the results?
We were. We very much expected that the positive thinkers coming in would show a really nice, strong, calming effect on the brain when we asked them to look on the bright side. That was something we expected to happen. What we didn't really expect to happen was that we would see this backfiring effect in the worriers. We figured that maybe they wouldn't show as big of a calming effect as the positive thinkers, but we really didn't expect that they would have this backfiring, even larger emotional response.
Were there any aha moments?
I think the aha moment for me was when we really started putting everything together. So these different questionnaires about how much effort they put in and looking at the brain activity. And then when we really saw the brain activity even before the picture came on, we put all of those pieces together and it really seemed to tell a story where these folks, these worriers in particular, were really trying hard. But when they were trying and they saw this picture and the picture came up and they were trying to look on the bright side, I think they really were saying, I can't do this. I never think this way. This is extremely hard. Or they were thinking, I don't believe that for a minute. I can't look on the bright side. This woman is going to get hurt.
Interesting. Jason Moser is an assistant professor of psychology here at Michigan State University. He's conducted a recent study looking at how brain functions differ between optimistic and pessimistic people. Does this suggest then, Jason, that being, and it sounds as if, that being an optimist or pessimist is just kind of hardwired into our brains and can't be changed?
Yeah, that's what...
Is
some
that part of the takeaway here?
That's what some people take away, and I think, you know, it's tough doing brain science sort of stuff because I think the automatic conclusion is, well, if it's in your brain, then it means we can't change it or that it's hardwired. And I think that's we got to tread lightly there because we know the brain changes over time. We know the brain is kind of always changing. Even when you're doing something pretty mundane, your brain is kind of adapting to the situation. So I think what these results really say to us is that we can appreciate in a different way, kind of in a more objective way, rather than just asking people who are positive and negative, how do you feel? We can see into their brains and see in a more objective way what it's like for them and appreciate what the process is really like, rather than just asking them.
Is what you learned in your study of real value to a clinician?
We hope so, that long term, that these results, in the short term, I think they are valuable in saying, if there are clinicians out there who are saying, well, look on the bright side, let's try to train Mr. or Mrs. Worrier or Mr. and Ms. Worrier to look on the bright side, I think this really tells them that this is going to be a tall order for them, that this is not something that they're going to easily practice. We've actually tried to practice in worriers doing this in the lab, and they don't take to it so quickly. And so I think for clinicians to think that you can have them look on the bright side, it's going to be a long haul, and perhaps taking different tacks instead that's out there in the research with worriers, for instance, trying to get them to focus more on the present moment. So be mindful, and mindful meditation is coming out more as a popular thing for worry, which is you just really try to stay in the present moment. Worry is so much about this future-oriented thinking, and you're not really with the other person you're with or doing what you're really doing. You're kind of off somewhere else in the future land about what bad might happen. Mm-hmm. So trying to focus people in on the present moment is something that we're really trying to help people do.
What motivated you to go down this road with this study?
Really, the lack of research that was out there for something that we thought was a pretty intuitive and basic question, which was, you know, what does the brain activity look like of positive and negative thinkers? We really don't have much out there in the research to tell us, so we felt like it was a real big gap because of what we kind of hear every day to day about positive and negative thinkers, how they must be so different, but we really didn't have any biological evidence for that. And we have this lay contention that everybody should just try to look on the bright side, but we didn't have any real brain data to suggest what is looking on the bright side look like, especially in these different types of people. So we thought it was a huge, you know, open question that we wanted to address.
Do you ever project your own individual tendencies into what you're studying, into a project like this?
Yeah, absolutely, because I study anxiety and worry and different patterns of thinking, and this is something that no matter if you're a patient or a test taker or anybody going through a bad day, we all have moments where we worry and we think negatively. And so then lots of times when we think positively. So I'm always thinking, you know, what implications does this research and these findings even have for my own life?
Yeah. You've got another project, other research going on in your lab called Minds Attitude and the Minds Attitude in Parenting Project. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the MAP project, as we call it, is looking at patterns of thinking, the way kids, actually we're looking at little kids between the ages of 5 and 8, so really young kids, trying to understand the way that they think and how the brain activity that we measure can help us understand how little kids think about themselves in particular, how they think about their own knowledge and their own intelligence, and how parenting also affects that. So we're looking at their pattern of thinking and how that relates to brain activity, as well as what the parents think about their own knowledge and how they talk about knowledge and knowing things in their children.
Very interesting. Jason Moser is an MSU assistant professor in psychology, and his recent study looked at how brain functions differ between optimistic and pessimistic people. Jason, thanks for joining us today. Good luck.
Thanks again.
It's Wednesday and time for Current State's Neighbors in Action segment, where we feature people and organizations working to make our community a better place. Today we feature the CASA for Kids in Eaton and Barry Counties. CASA stands for Court-Appointed Special Advocates for Children. Here to tell us more is Becky Carson, the Executive Director of CASA for Kids in Eaton and Barry Counties. Welcome to Current State, Becky.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having us. We appreciate being here.
Sure. Tell us a little more about the work you do here, CASA for Kids. You're part of a national organization, I understand.
Correct. CASA, the full mission of CASA is to advocate for the best interest of children in the foster care system. So we train volunteers from the community, general community, as advocates, and their role is solely to advocate for what is in the child's best interest so that they're receiving the kind of services that they need to receive, as well as the most appropriate, safe, and caring permanent home. CASA is started from as in Seattle, Washington, actually, when a judge felt that they were receiving a lot of different treatments. They're the same treatment plans, I guess you would say, on every single child. And knowing that every child has different individual needs, he started training volunteers and appointing them to children. So the volunteers are actually appointed as an officer of the court. And that volunteer's role was to be appointed to one child or a sibling group, one case, essentially. And they would advocate for that child to make sure that they were receiving the kind of services they need, that their needs were met, and that they were working towards the most appropriate placement, which was either reunification with the parents or possibly termination of the parents' rights, and then eligibility for adoption. Mm-hmm. So,
well, go a little bit deeper with us. Tell us what is it that your volunteers offer these kids? More specifically, what is it that they are offering that they're most often not getting?
Volunteers, and it's actually a pretty extensive role. The volunteer, they end up being appointed to an individual child, and they will visit that child every 7 to 10 days in the home, develop a relationship with the child, which is a supportive relationship, doing activities sometimes in a sort of mentoring capacity, getting to know the child's needs. They end up talking with the foster parents or wherever the child is placed, as well as teachers or other professionals that are working with the child to kind of understand the child's needs and to be able to, they end up writing a court report that goes to the judge. They attend court, provide court testimony, and their whole role is really just to make sure that all of the child's needs are being met and working towards the most appropriate placement.
What kinds of issues do these kids most often present when you connect with them?
Almost every child is in
Is it isolation? Are they not connected to an adult on a regular basis?
Well, some of the real extensive needs that children in foster care always have is they've been through abusive situations, abuse or neglect, substance abuse, just a lot of different impact that trauma has on children. And so counseling is also always something that is important for children to have. Children in foster care, and they even once they get into foster care, in addition to needing a lot of supportive and counseling services to address their needs, they frequently will move from place to place.
Yeah.
And so most children that I know, worked in the system for 20 years, most kids that I know have probably had 4 to 5 moves during the time that a year and a half period. And so those are losses. And so any time that a child has a loss, they've lost their biological family, they have to address the loss issues there in rejection. And then every time that they have another placement change, that's another loss in relationships. So kids in the system frequently have trouble developing healthy relationships and attachments.
Yeah.
So that's a really huge thing. And one of the benefits that CASA provides is the CASA volunteer is consistent. They're appointed in the beginning of a court case when the child comes into care, and then they remain with that child until the case essentially closes and either the child is adopted or reunified with a parent. Most kids have, in addition to a lot of placement changes, they also have a lot of caseworker transition. That's a very high turnover job, high stress job, and so most children have had multiple caseworkers as
well. So you offer continuity, is what you're saying.
Right.
Becky Carson is the executive director of CASA for Kids in Eaton and Barry counties. We're talking about her work out there. Can you give us a sense of how many abused and neglected kids there are in Eaton and Barry counties?
Absolutely. There are generally 110 on a month-to-month basis in Eaton County and 60 on a month-to-month basis in Barry County, approximately. So between the two counties, there's usually around 170 children in foster care.
Is there a story that comes to mind that captures why you do the work you do?
Yeah, we have a wonderful volunteer who began working. She was appointed to a young boy who was 7. And when she started with him, I think she wasn't really sure that it was making that much of a difference. He was not someone who wanted to talk about any of the abuse or anything that happened in his life. But she came week after week to visit with him, get to know him, develop a relationship, and play games with him. And he was safe in the placement that he was placed in. As the mom was working with services, kind of minimally, there were a lot of concerns and issues with the parent. He was removed due to a lot of substance abuse issues. But she was working to address some of those things, minimally, especially more so when she realized her rights were about to be terminated.
Hmm.
And they extended the time and started to have visits that were unsupervised. And this provoked a lot of anxiety for the little boy, who really hadn't shared a lot of the history prior. And I think essentially because he felt safe in the home that he was in. So at this point, he actually began sharing those concerns with the volunteer, because the volunteer was someone who had been with him all along and had developed that relationship. And the information that was shared was pretty integral in changing the direction of the court case, so that they were working towards, they pulled back on the visits, and then, and as they began looking into all these issues, the case direction changed to termination of the mom's rights. And that was very significant in that later on, the mom ended up overdosing and passed away of an overdose. So very significant that, you know, the volunteer was able to intervene in that capacity. And in addition to that, the relational continuity and the relationship that the volunteer provides to the child is also something that is just so needed for kids in the system.
Yeah.
And like this particular woman, the young boy just really, really enjoyed. She almost became part of the family.
Yeah.
He invited her to grandparents' day at school. So it was someone that he considered, you know, so close to him. She's almost kind of considered part of the family.
Uh-huh.
So that's something that's really an exceptional benefit for children in foster care. And the boundaries are a little bit different than someone in a professional role. So even after, and he's now in the process of being adopted by a relative, very happy in the home that he's in. So, but I'm sure after that case closes completely and adoption is finalized, I'm sure that she will be able to remain involved in his life in some capacity. So, and that's also a benefit that's available. So,
tell us where your funding comes from.
We are about 50% of our funding is through the county, and the rest of that, which is a little over 50%, we raise. So it's a combination of United Way funds. We're funded through Barry Eaton and Capital Area United Way, as well as grant funding. Right now, Capital Region Community Foundation, Gannett Foundation, Jackson National Community Fund are some of our grantors. So, and as well as fundraising events, we have three fundraising events that we do each year. One coming up is the 22nd annual golf scramble in Hastings, and we have that coming up May 31st. So, significant right now, we're actually raising money to be able to add on an additional staff. So that we can serve more children. We actually, in Eaton County, we the judge and referee refer to CASA. To have a CASA volunteer on every single case. So the demand is significant.
How encouraging. Yeah. You're reliant on volunteers, obviously. How much training, how much preparation do you give your volunteers?
They go through a 7-week training process, so it's pretty extensive, where it also it combines with court observation as well. So there's about 40 hours of training that they go through before they become a CASA volunteer. Covers a lot of different areas, like the issues that are common for children that have experienced abuse or neglect, the type of families that they come from, how to interact with professionals in the system, collaborate with the DHS workers and caseworkers, communicate and advocate effectively in court, write court reports. So it's pretty extensive training.
And if we've probably got a few mm-hmm. people listening who might sure. consider volunteering, if people are interested, what can they do?
They could go to our website, www.barryeatoncasa.org, and it gives information about how to contact our organization. The phone number is 517-543-7500, extension 1648.
Very good. BarryEatonCASA.org is the website, and Becky Carson is the executive director of CASA for Kids in Eaton and Barry Counties. Becky, thanks for joining us today. Good luck to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
We could always use more nominations, and we know there are people and organizations out there doing excellent work. We need to know about them, though. Please help us out and tweet us suggestions at KAR Current State, or send us an email to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. It's Current State on WKAR. Welcome back. Each year, in honor of National Poetry Month here in April, the MSU Residential College in the Arts and Humanities Center for Poetry brings a series of poets to campus to conduct readings and workshops with the public. Current State welcomes Poetry Center Director Anita Skeen and the State of Virginia Poet Laureate Sophia Starnes to talk about wrapping up this year's festival. First of all, Sophia, welcome to Michigan.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
And Anita, nice to have you with
Thank
us
you.
As well. How was it Sophia became a part of this year's Poetry Festival, Anita?
Well, I'm teaching a course this semester in the Residential College in the Arts and Humanities, a 380 junior level tutorial, and I decided we would focus on Poets Laureate. So we wanted to have the U.S. Poet Laureate, Natasha Trethewey, whom we had several weeks ago, a City Poet Laureate, and a State Poet Laureate.
Okay.
So when I started looking around for State Poet Laureates, I discovered Sophia, whose work I really didn't know anything about. And when I read a book called Fully Into Ashes, I thought, this is it. This is who we want.
forgive us for talking about you as if you're not here, Sophia. But what has your term as Poet Laureate in Virginia been like?
2 years. It's a 2-year term, and it's been wonderful. It's been exciting. It's been very, very busy. You go around the state. You get a chance to have a soapbox. You know, you feel like this is your moment. You better take advantage of it. This is when people listen. After that, they may not listen to you again. So I've always believed that next to writing my own poetry, connecting a poem to a reader is what I value the most, what I enjoy the most. I'm also an editor. So it just was a natural joy to have an opportunity to do that.
What kind of response do you get? What kind of random type responses do you get when you tell people you're a poet and you're the Poet Laureate for the state of Virginia? What's the the general response to that?
Depends on who you're talking to, but the general response is, oh, we had a Poet Laureate, or what's that? A little bit like that. But then when you start talking a little bit about what you feel poetry is, and it's not an exclusive or elite thing for a few people, but something that's out there, then they open up and they say, well yeah, I remember a poem that I read, or I remember a poem I met. So then that's the opening.
And Anita, falling into ashes.
Fully into ashes.
Fully into ashes made quite an impression on you. How so?
It was different from a lot of the poetry that we were reading of other poets laureate, and it was very heavily imagistic and delicious language. I'm so eager to hear Sophia read tonight because I see these poems on the page, and the language and the images just goes cascading around all over the place, and it's poetry that requires work, but the payoff is great.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, Sophia, would you mind indulging us here in reciting a poem of yours?
I would be very happy to do that.
From Fully Into Ashes?
Actually, unfortunately, the book that I have here is from because I'm reading quite a number of poems from Fully Into Ashes tonight. I have Commerce of Moments, which is another of my books, but it's similar in the sense of language, and I believe in that poetry creates a country, and you're inviting people to get into that, to walk into that landscape, walk into the country with you. So those are that's what the words are, the part of the landscape. So you try to entice people. And this poem is called A Viable Goodbye, or Nunc Dimittis. And I brought it because it starts with daily images of your child, my childhood growing up, but then it opens up and it starts putting in words of things I've seen and people I've known. And at the end, the realization of the poem is, I wouldn't be here if not for the others. Where did you get these words? You know, they're through the words of others that the poem is capable of being. So even though poetry is an isolated endeavor, you're never really alone. You're taking words from other people, your phrases. Okay. So if you want, identical are daily movements into sleep. The bed lamp swiveled off, the sigh of shoulders idling into a place. We hollow out a cave for the left hip, and the left hand slips under the pillow with its beads dangerously tight. We've done this all our lives, since Papa crossed our foreheads with his thumb, pulling the sheets over our shoulders. Other things change. We do not drop raw egg into our soup or boil sweet onions. We walk barefoot, despite Mama's clear intonation. You must wear your slippers in the house. And sometime between 3 and 4, we rearrange a rosary. Our days are pure and plentiful. Hawks in a backyard roost. A starling arcs under a makeshift protection. A single lily pond. A single goldfish races the ripple, lip over lip until the coming eyes. We pluck, we pull, we repossess. This word for that loquacious life. That word for unentangled hours. The neighbor's foxglove spring, the next door gutter pouring out its rain, the singular procession trickling by with its own widower. Once more, we open up the linen, peel after peel, we unroll the Blackstone litany, through them, with them, in them. So little have we done to call our own, so little.
A Viable Goodbye by Sophia Starnes, one of our guests here today on Current State. There's a real intimacy to that, mm-hmm. too, mm-hmm. that was really quite striking. Sophia, how do you know when a poem is finished? And what's the longest you've ever worked on a poem?
I'm still working on a poem that was published 10 years ago. I don't know. Sometimes some poems tell you that they're finished. But most of the time, was it Auden who said, poems are never finished, they're abandoned. You get to a point where you just can't do anything to this poem. And then you find out when you read it aloud to a group, something clicks and you say, oh, maybe that word was not quite right. So I don't have a very good answer for that. I think sometimes they tell you, but other times you just say, well, that's it. That's about as close as I can get.
Your anthology that came out in March is called The Nearest Poem Anthology, which talks about the multiple lives of poetry. What do you mean by that?
I think that a poem has a new life every time it is read by somebody else. There's nothing else I can do with this poem after I've written it and it's out. But every time somebody reads it, they give it
a
new life.
Take possession of it in a way.
And they echo it through their own life. And so in that book, each poem that is published has been submitted by a reader in Virginia that gave that poem a new life by reading it. And so they include a little essay that says, well, this poem means this much to me because of this reason, for this reason. And that's the new life of the poem.
We're talking with Virginia, State of Virginia Poet Laureate Sophia Starnes and the Poetry Center Director Anita Skeen of ARCA, the MSU Residential College in the Arts and Humanities Center for Poetry. Anita, Michigan is one of the few states that does not have a poet laureate. Why is that? What determines whether a state has a poet laureate or not?
Well, usually the legislature and the governor determine whether or not the state has a poet laureate. And we are beginning to work with some other groups. The Center for Poetry is around the state in thinking about what we can do to make a movement forward to see about establishing a poet laureate here for the state of Michigan. A number of groups of poets around town, the Old Town Poets, the Lansing Poetry Society, the Center for Poetry, and some in other parts of the state. I believe there are 44 states now that have poet laureates, six that don't. Does that add up to 50? Arizona just recently added a poet laureate for the first time, and they chose Alberto Rios for their first poet laureate, which was a wonderful choice. So we would like to very soon be able to say in the next couple of years, Michigan has a poet laureate, and this is who it is.
Anita, you also have recently published a new book of poetry with Laura DeLind, who's been in our program before,
yes,
called The Unauthorized Audubon. What's that about?
Well, it's a collection of poems and linocuts. In addition to being an anthropologist, Laura is a wonderful visual artist, and she does these incredible linocuts. And through our friendship, we started a project where I would take one of the linocuts she had done and I would write a poem in response to it. And these all turned out to be birds. She is fabulous in her ability to create life through black and white ink. And so the book is a collection of 22 linocuts and poems about these imaginary birds. And my favorite part of the project was when she gave me the linocut, I got to name the bird.
Oh my, what an honor.
It was marvelous. And then I wrote a poem. Sometimes the poem was a description of the bird, sometimes the poem was about what the bird did, or sometimes it was a link to my own experience with what that painting or linocut reminded me of.
Anita, do you have some of your work with us? Would you indulge us?
I brought one of those poems, and since Easter is on the horizon this weekend, I thought I would read one called The Resurrection Birds. And it's called that because the little birds that Laura made the print of reminded me of these mourning doves who sit on the wire outside my house. And I've often thought, my mother has passed away, and two of my aunts also have, in a very short period of time. And there have been times when I look up and see those three mourning doves sitting on the wire, and I think of the three of them. So this is called The Resurrection Birds. They always come back this time of year like migratory birds whose out-of-whack radar sends them north, not south, when winter arrives. If there are three mourning doves huddled on the wire, I know Bea and Phyllis and Grace have flown in for the Christmas season, though my mother hated the cold weather, as did my aunts. They were raised in the mountains where, young working women, they posed in their wool coats and fur-topped high-heel boots for the old black-and-white Kodak. Snow covered the ground around them. They pinched their collars tight against the wind. They cooed their laments about the weather. I hope there is sunshine now in their new home, some hot tea if the temperature drops, peppermint sticks, or lemon chiffon pie. They never appear as their whole selves these days, just a glimpse of a hand with a thin gold band or a fuzzy blue sock. Like birds, they are quick, erratic, and often drop a feather. Like birds, once in flight, they cannot be called back.
The Resurrection Birds. Anita Skeen from, and I love the title, The Unauthorized Audubon. What a stroke of genius that is. As if anything could ever exist, but you and Laura created it. I know faith has played a role in your work, Sophia. Tell us about what your spiritual life has meant to your writing.
Very, very strong. I was raised a Catholic family, and we moved. We left the Philippines in a state of political unrest and moved to a new country in Spain. And then after that, when I married my husband, I've lived in the United States in Virginia longer than I've lived anywhere in my life. But my faith is something that has taken me everywhere. It's a universal sense of the value of human life, the value of humanity as a created creature with love sustaining. So when I never sit down to write a religious poem or a faith poem. It's just something that I carry inside me. So I find myself using liturgical images, or even that through them, with them, in them is actually a line. We say through you, with you, in you, and during the Mass. So that weaves its way mm-hmm. into the poems as a layered life, as that there's this life and then there's the other life, but it's not two separate lives. It's mm-hmm. an incarnate life. Then, so never explicitly for a particular faith, but just a sense of faith as a sustaining thing in my life.
There will be an informal conversation with Sophia Starnes this afternoon at 3 p.m. in Snyder Room C304, Snyder Hall C304. Later tonight at 7 p.m., Ms. Starnes will be giving a reading in the Arca Theater, that is Snyder C20. Anita Skeen will be reading from her new book with Laura DeLinde on the Unauthorized Audubon. I love that. Laura DeLinde on Thursday, May 1st at 7 p.m. at Schuller's in Okemos. We thank you both for joining us, and we hope
thank
you enjoy your stay.
Thank you very
Michigan.
Much for having us. It's been delightful.
Continued success.
Thank you.
Is our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, the Ford Mustang celebrates its 50th birthday tomorrow. We'll take a look back at the history of the pony car. Also, we'll learn more about the Michigan Veterans Trust Fund, which helps combat era veterans facing economic emergencies. That and more Thursday on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current States on WKAR.